We need to move forward and insist that when we see conducts that violate accepted norms of international law, we insist that those conducts are that bad and not lose ourselves in the madness of the moment.
Today, I'm talking to Justice Chile Ebo Osuji, who has had a long and illustrious career as a judge, prosecutor, a legal and special advisor at some of the most prominent courts and institutions in the world, including the International Criminal Court and the United Nations. So if I can just start with your beginnings in international criminal law, what initially drew you to this field?
The beginnings must, of course, go back to when I started studying it in the university in my LRB program around 1984, I think it was. And it was a year-long course in the LRB program. And because it was so small and there wasn't a diversity of offerings of courses, all the essential courses you needed to practice law, including advice or clients, were offered. And one of them was international law. So I got taken by it ever since then, and also did it in my master's degree at McGill University. When we were studying it in those days, of course, there was something romantic about the concept. I mean, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, as we were in those days, it sounded fascinating and completely out of reach, theoretical and all that. You didn't think this is something you would practice at any time. It was interesting to study it. And there was only a select few who would occasionally appear before the International Court of Justice at the time to argue these cases. So you didn't think you would be anywhere near those sort of institutions. But it was in the nature of things that the discipline took off in its own right, especially the area in which I later specialized, which is international criminal justice. The Rwandan genocide, the Balkan wars gave a huge impetus to that. And I happened again to be one of those lucky enough to be recruited to work as a prosecutor at International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. It is something now that is studied in universities as a specialty in international criminal law. You didn't do it at earlier times. So it has grown exponentially, yes. And here we are, ICC established and other international ad hoc tribunals, mechanisms established to administer international criminal justice. So it has grown in that sense and others.
You mentioned the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and you're also involved in the Special Court for Sierra Leone, and of course at the ICC more recently. So perhaps taking them in turn, what would you say the greatest challenges of those roles were?
The greatest challenges of those roles come really from the essential, some would say, a weakness, but I think it's essential character of international law, in that you do not have a Leviathan who hovers over the world implementing these norms of international law. You have an aggregation of states who have to make it work. So the efficacy of international law depends on the willingness of each and every state to make it work. And that in itself generates serious challenges to the project that continues to resonate. So that, I would say that that would be perhaps the greatest source of challenge to international law. It was that in the project of International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, and even more profoundly so for the ICC. So that would be, in my view, the greatest source of challenge for the work.
international justice is sometimes derided as being disproportionately slow, expensive, ineffective as a deterrent. How would you counter these criticisms?
You know, I'm not impressed by those so-called criticisms. I just see them as unstudied propositions that anchored only in limited impressions that people may have, limited perspectives. When someone says disproportionately slow compared to what? Disproportionately expensive compared to what? Disproportionately ineffective, again, compared to what? Has anyone done any study that sets the frame for comparison? No one has done that. I remember when I was at the ICTR, there was a colleague of mine from the United States, who was a teammate on my team. And that question came up. This person said, you know what? People say this thing about administration of international justice. Do you know that one case of white-collar crimes in the U.S., right, the expenses of those kinds of cases, right, the ICTR expenses do not compare at all, taken together, all the cases. Compare it to how much the world spends in some of those events that give rise to the need for international administration of justice. Talking about weapons, right, as we speak, the estimate is that the world spends more than $2.4 trillion annually now on a military infrastructure, and see the kind of havoc they cause. Now, what is the benchmark for peace annually? What are states required to do every year to make peace an actionable proposition? Nobody asks that question. And then I'm asked, well, it is too expensive to do international criminal justice.
So we're seeing at the moment contemporary cases, for example, with Ukraine, there's a special tribunal that's being set up. And with Russia and Israel, there are ICC arrest warrants that are out. Is this sort of the best that international law can do? Is there any more that could be done to try to end these conflicts, perhaps?
In my view, there is still more that international law can do. And one of the, in a perverse way, so to speak, when the world experiences these spates of depressing episodes, as we are now seeing, which is not the first time the world has seen stuff like this, by the way, in a perverse sort of way, it ought to, and it had in the past, galvanized those who think it's about asking what more can be done in the realms of international law to address these bad behavior. I remember earlier I said that I made allusion to how the weakness of international law, it is its essential nature that's dependent on states for implementation. This is one area where we might start exploring how to use states more to enforce international law through the processes of international law, for them to go back to the drawing board. So think what else can be done to address these spates of madness we see. Again, not the first time this has happened. And if you looked, one can see that it is conduct like this that have actually resulted in the growth and law reforms of international law, tweaking it up to capture behaviors like that. So this is with it now at that moment, the idea being in a limited way to focus on peace as an actionable human right, actionable in the sense that once we accept that peace has value, we give it that legal value so that violation of peace or people's right to peace should result in consequences to those who violate the right to peace. The essential matter of it is to consider the adoption of treaty, not an extensive treaty that runs the pages of the Rome Statute, that could be limited in the sense of the Convention Against Genocide that is 2 pages at the most in length, limited in that way. So we give states through this international treaty on the right to peace, the national jurisdictions are given the authority to inquire into violation of rights to peace of human beings around the world, or states around the world. So that those who are engaged in that process, who engage in that conduct, are held accountable in a civil court in national jurisdictions, in a judgment, civil judgment, not necessarily criminal, but civil liability, the judgment of which is enforced in all member states of that treaty. Once you do that, you're now hitting the bottom line, the pocketbooks of those who engage in this violation, on these attacks against peace. It will make people start thinking twice, because right now we don't have that, but that's something else that could be tried. Hold them accountable. Judgment that is issued by a court in the United States saying somebody's right to peace had been violated in Ukraine can be enforced in Switzerland against or any other place where the culprit of the conduct would have assets. You go after them and touch their property. Once you diversify enforcement in that way, I do believe that people will start thinking twice more than they are doing now about engaging in this, flagrant violations of people's right to dignity.
What do you think the most pressing challenges facing international law today are, if you could summarize it?
I think what needs to be done is for people who believe in law and order at international level, who believe in the order of civilization as we know it, as a minimum level that can be built upon from here on, to insist that when we see conduct that is against those norms, we insist that they are against those norms, and not begin to ask, okay, does this mean there's a change in paradigm? Yeah, you ask yourself, what change in paradigm? Where does that paradigm shift take us? Is it going to take us to a world in which it is correct, or it is no longer something of moment for people to commit genocide? It is no longer a moment for people to engage in slavery and the slave trade. It is no longer a moment for people to just go in and occupy by violence the states of others. Is that what we mean by are we seeing a shift in paradigm? I hate to see the world, a world in which by what is done from now going forward, we'll now look back. Oh, maybe it wasn't against international law to have engaged in the Holocaust. I just recall in that kind of view of the world, because that is the retroactive outcome of accepting this paradigm shift. It is no longer wrong to say that the slavery and slave trade were unlawful in international law. So we need to move forward and insist that when we see conduct that violate accepted norms of international law, we insist that those conducts are that bad, and not lose ourselves in the madness of the moment